Hello, and a very warm welcome to episode 38 of the Gita Decoded. Today we will be looking at chapter 10, the Yoga of Manifestation. If you have been following this entire series, you will know that Sister Denise has been sharing with us her understanding and her experience of the Bhagavad Gita, the text, as well as her spiritual experiences. Sister Denise, thank you so much for being with us yet again.
Thank you.
I notice that this chapter starts with God expressing his concern for Arjuna's future. And the last two lines read, "Which I shall speak to you who are beloved with a desire for your welfare." Sister Denise, the two things that come to mind is God calls Arjuna beloved, which is very sweet, very, very sweet indeed. And also that it is implied that if you do not care about tomorrow, none of this will be of interest to you. What is the message that Arjuna is receiving from God as far as this stanza is concerned?
I think that Arjuna is being grown up, you know, from being the confused man. And he's being prepared to be the great king, you know. And so he is extremely cherished by God, because God has found in Arjuna someone who truly loves him. After all, why are they together in the chariot on the battlefield? Is because Arjuna said, "I want you. I don't need any of your powers or anything. I just want you." So this is going to sit very deeply with God, that you just want me, so therefore I am totally available to you. Now God says, okay, now I'm going to take you to the next level, because you are such a being that you are worthy. So I'm going to show you myself on a level that is very different. Up until now, it's been the friendly one, Krishna, the attractive one, giving him encouragement, teaching him, but now he really wants to take him to a much higher level of maturity, and Arjuna has to be able to apprehend God and see the much more larger secret veiled form. So God is unveiling himself before Arjuna.
The two souls, God and Arjuna, they have complete love for each other, don't they?
Complete.
That's quite something.
Well, this is the wonder, you know, in the human world, so many people, they relate to God for what they can get out of him, or they relate to humanity, what they can take. You know, we are takers. But here you have the lover and beloved who just want each other, you know, and that is the highest potential in a human being. And the most perfect relationship between a human being and God. And so that shows us, okay, this is what it looks like to be in perfect relationship with God. Now you do like this.
Whew, that was quite an experience, Sister Denise. I think we'll take it up further in the synopsis. We now go to verse 2. Where it reads, "Neither the multitude of gods, small g, nor the great seers know my origin, capital M. In truth, I am the source of the gods and the great seers." Once again, God is revealing how elusive he is.
And if you go further to the third verse, it makes it even more clear how inaccessible he is. And it also makes it very clear to us that it doesn't matter how much a person tries, using whatever means they can, they cannot figure out God. God can only be known when he chooses to let you know him.
That's very interesting, Sister Denise, because there are exceptionally intelligent people on this planet of ours. There are those who have sacrificed everything and everyone with the sole purpose of just being with God. Mm-hmm. There are individuals who have lived in mountaintops for years and years and years with only one desire, to know God. And this is very clear, that none of them come to Him because He remains hidden.
Yes. Unless He opens Himself up to you. And of course it is possible. There is a form of devotion called Noda Bhakti.
Say that again.
Noda Bhakti, the nine forms of devotion. Mm. Many different kinds of austerities. And when you do that to a particular degree, which is a very extreme degree, then God will give you a vision. But a vision of God is not the same as God Himself comes into your life. So even then, even if you have a vision of God, you wouldn't necessarily understand it. And anyway, God will give you a vision according to your existing belief. So if you believe in God as one particular demigod, and you get a vision of that demigod, it will verify for you that yes, that demigod is God, but it isn't.
Sister Denise, on that note, loving God, a human being loving God, it's not a one birth thing, is it? It's an eternal thing, isn't it? You can't just say, I will love God in this birth only, and in my next incarnation I'll love someone else.
Well, you see, as you go through life after life after life, definitely you will come into connection with beautiful human beings who you will love. And that is a beautiful thing, but then it distracts you away from God. So I think that one of the things that happens, and in fact even perhaps one of the reasons why celibacy is so important in Raj Yoga, is that, you know, you have turned away from God towards some beautiful God-like human being, and now you have to turn away from all human beings and turn towards the One. And so what I think happens is that the residual love that you have had for human beings will take the form of a veil between you and God. So I think the level of renunciation of the attraction to attractive people gradually progresses, so that ultimately there is no human being who can draw your attention. One of the practices that we have in Brahma Kumari's Raj Yoga is that if you see somebody who has brilliant intellect or perfect virtues, always remember who gave them that, so that it doesn't deviate you away from God. Because if somebody has a brilliant intellect, well, they got it from God. If somebody has a beautiful face, a beautiful character, it originated in God.
There are many distractions, aren't there?
There are. You know, there's attractions and repulsions, and the mind is pulled by those things. And when the mind is pulled into an attraction or a distraction or a repulsion, then it's not focused on God. So we have to be neutral about everything, dispassionate about everything. And gradually the veils fall away and you're able to stay focused on God.
I now want to move on to Shloka 4 and 5, where a number of virtues are mentioned. The first question, do all virtues emanate from God? All virtues present in human beings, do they all emanate from God?
The way I see it is this: God is called the ocean of virtue. So all the virtues are contained within God, and God is the giver. So I would say that it's as if God planted a few virtues in a few different people, and they're seeds, and then our duty is to cultivate those seeds and make them manifest. But I think definitely it is correct to say that all the virtues originated in God, and they are, you know, present in his children, part of his legacy to us.
What I find particularly interesting about Shloka number 5 is that it starts with the words non-violence, impartiality, contentment, etc., but non-violence. Now, when we meet Krishna and Arjuna at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, our good friend Arjuna is armed to the teeth. Okay, and then he realizes that his arrow might land in a family member, and so he becomes despondent. And now we hear about non-violence. It is something that has confused scholars for many a century, because there's a war which involves violence, and then there's God who has to be non-violent and who speaks of non-violence, and he's encouraging his non-violent son and friend to war. So bring all of that together for us, because it boggles the mind.
Even within Brahma Kumaris, there are people who come, they're in the military, they're in the police, and they have this question, you know, I'm armed with my pistol, my truncheon, my Kalashnikov, whatever it is, and I have a duty to protect the country or to ensure that there is peace in the civil arena. And so the instruction that will be given to them is this, you know, shoot in remembrance.
And the karma of that is?
See, you have a duty. If you're in the military, you have a duty to protect your country. And there is a difference between performing military activity according to the rules of war and then the frenzy of violence.
Which is taking the law into your own hands.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. You know, if you are getting caught up in the whole process of violence, which actually is anger, it's a vice, and you are really going beyond your duty, then you cross a line, you see. And so I think that this is what is being said, that violence is a passion, and you have to perform. Like if you take the example of martial arts, the martial arts is military, but you have to, you cannot be in any kind of state of passion, otherwise you'll make a mistake. Because you cannot judge properly when your intellect is clouded by the passion of violence. And people who, you know, perform an act with weapons that is dispassionate, it's not called violence. You see what I mean? I mean, even with your tongue, you can do an act of violence by saying something really cutting to somebody. There's a violence. And you'll do it because of a motive of passion. You'll hurt somebody badly with a word or even look.
Tell us more about non-violence. I understand what you said about people in the military and police, etc. But for somebody who's not involved in a profession that involves violence, and personally, what is God's message about non-violence to Arjuna?
If you go to the description of a divine person, a deity, God with a little g, they are called Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. That means non-violent of the highest dharma. You see, so non-violence means that all of your passions are restrained and subdued and controlled. You see, so you have power. And do you abuse it? If you abuse your power, that's violence. If you can contain your power and use it correctly under every circumstance, that would be non-violence, I would say. You know, sometimes people associate non-violence with being unable to say no, unable to stand up for themselves, unable to defend their rights. You know, the concept of violence has to be really thought through, and the concept of standing up for yourself, defending, being able to say no, being able to be strong and determined, all of this is part of being in your power. But I think it only crosses over into violence when you're losing control of your capacity to manage your abilities, your powers.
So, Denise, how then is Arjuna to engage in war?
Well, you see, ultimately, you find Arjuna saying, okay, I have understood, I've given up my attachments, I'll fight. So what he's doing, in fact, in this war, is performing non-attached action. He is not fighting against people, really. We remember always that the Gita is an allegory. And you see, when you are attached, you cannot do the right thing. For example, in medical surgery, surgeons are not allowed to operate on their relatives because of the emotional connection.
And the judge is not allowed to preside in the case of a family member or a friend for the same reason.
Right, you see. So we're not able to be detached because of the blood connection. And his attachment is because of the blood connection. And so everything that Krishna is telling him is you have to be able to perform action non-attached. It means without any emotion, without any bond, without any dependency. Just whatever is the right action, do it dispassionately and let go. And so the whole thing is, how do we know what's right? And this is a extraordinary examination of right action. So the philosophy of karma is there threaded all the way through.
I would now like to go through shlokas 7 through to 9. And what I find interesting about it is that what is contained in these three shlokas is that God is saying, to understand all of who I am, you need yoga. 9 reads as follows: those who think of me, who absorb their lives in me, enlightening each other and speaking of me constantly, they are content and rejoice.
Look at what's happening to us. As much as we start talking about God, that much we enjoy.
Yes, I'm on a high right now.
No, but it's true. You know, otherwise what happens? People talk about each other, they find fault. You don't get into that energized state. When you're talking about God, you're talking about what God stands for, it takes you up.
What I find interesting is that the last line reads, they are content and rejoice. One struggles to find anyone in this world who's content. They'll be happy today for something that happened or someone that happened into their lives, but there's no guarantee that that happiness will last tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And to have somebody who says, I am content always, is very rare.
Well, you have to be absolutely detached from what's going on, because it's good, it's bad, it's happy, it's unhappy, it's success, it's failure. It's connected with that equanimity. In equanimity, in that equilibrium, dispassion, detachment, you will be content, because you're taking your happiness not from what's going on in the world, but from the deep understanding of who is God, what is your relationship with God, and how the whole game is going on.
Verse 10, to those who are constantly steadfast, those who worship me with love, I give the yoga of discrimination by which they come to me. What does that mean in that context? It's a gift that God gives, and they come to him as a result of that gift.
again, it's a matter of the interpretation. If you look at the Sanskrit, it's talking about buddhi yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Now, buddhi is the intelligence.
Mm.
A yoga is a connection. And buddhi yoga is a word that we use a great deal in Brahma Kumaris. In our translations, we will say yoga of the intellect, but in English, yoga of the intellect doesn't have any meaning.
Mm.
So I have played with that expression, buddhi yoga, a great deal. Mm. And I found that it seems to work quite well to say focus of attention for buddhi yoga. You're trying to focus your attention on God. Your mind wavers. Your concentration moves away. But if God is pleased with you and says, okay, you come to me, I'll catch you and hold you to myself, seems to me that it's something like that. Like if we're looking at each other, we're holding each other's gaze, right? And it takes two to have this. Now, if I'm just me and I'm wanting to hold my attention to God, but my attention is distracted by something or another in the material world, then I will lose that connection. But if I'm connected in such a way that it's a two-sided thing, you know, God is holding me, I'm holding God, it's like a gift. Do you see what I'm saying? So I interpret it a little bit that there is that. Aspect, because a relationship is always two ways. So I think this, I give buddhi yoga to you, I give you the ease of staying in connection with me through your focus of attention, because your focus of attention is something that is done with the buddhi, with the intellect. You see, the mind doesn't do focusing. The mind isn't a muscle. The intellect is a muscle. The mind is a sense perception type of thing. But the muscle of the intellect holds the mind to God, and then the mind experiences.
Okay. So Denise, I think that we should stop here. I have a lot of questions and too little time. So I think we'll take up the next part of chapter 10 in the next episode. And I really would like to thank you, because if one reads the text on these pages, you understand one thing. And now if you... Now that you've given a different interpretation of it, your understanding of it, it gives the Bhagavad Gita a whole new complexion. And you know what's curious? It's not about the book. It's about the beholder. It's about the reader. Okay? You know, you were speaking about a relationship being two people engaging with the eyes, which you were saying involves God and human souls as well. The same with the Bhagavad Gita. My relationship with the Bhagavad Gita, it depends as much on the text as it does the reader. It's fascinating that, well, I read this many times and I didn't see it the way you did, and I'm sure the viewers at home are having the same experience. Interpretation is a fascinating subject.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. So thank you. I really, really thank you on my own behalf, as well as on behalf of the viewers who are sitting there at home with the Bhagavad Gita on their lap, agape at how magnificent the scripture really is. So there you go. Sister Denise has shared her understanding of the chapter 10 of the Bhagavad Gita with us, and some lovely concepts have come up in this discussion. What does non-violence mean? What does yoga mean? How does God give the return of love to his children? All of this is taken up line after line in the Bhagavad Gita, and the message is so deep and profound, and I hope it has made an impact on your life. I really hope that you can find some solace and some strength from that which was shared today. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to see you soon. Take care and goodbye.